I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where I speak with creative entrepreneurs, artists, and other insanely interesting people to hear their stories, learn about their molding moments, tipping points, and spectacular takeoffs.
An epic journey of driving an ambulance from the United Kingdom to Mongolia became a turning point in Chris Pyle's life. When he returned to the United States, he realized that he could not return to the life he was living before. Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by 99designs.com. As all of you know, in the online world today, your brand is the face of your business, and if it doesn't look good, people are going to bail from your website. You have to make a great impression with your brand. And at 99designs.com, you can get access to over 310,000 graphic designers, and you can get just about anything designed, including logos, t-shirts, websites, and much, much more. Go to 99designs.com/creative and get a $99 power pack of services for free today. And don't forget, when you support our sponsors, you support our show. Chris, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks, Srini. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, I came across you by way of our mutual friend, Jason Gaynard. And, you know, I overheard you telling your story when we were sitting at, a bar at World Domination Summit. And as I was overhearing you tell the story, I was like, okay, that's a story we have to tell on the podcast. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, you know, your story, your journey, and sort of the journey before the journey that's led you to where you're at today?
Yeah, I definitely will. And I guess to preface this, this year for me has been a year of incredible highs and incredible lows. The trip through Siberia was an incredible high, but I've also lost the three men in my life who I looked most up to in the past, I guess it's been the past 5 months or so. So it's been a year of a lot of reflection also. And so, you know, many of the things that I see that I've done since, like the trip to Siberia, I've been just tunneling down the roots of kind of where did that impetus begin? Where did that drive begin? Why did I want to do those things? So it's been that year of self-reflection. I think that what many people get interested in is the trek to Siberia, but where it began for me was going back to about 2007 or so. I was had left a company and had started one of my own, and the company was doing really well. So it was the first full successful entrepreneurial endeavor that I did that had traction and success. But it was all consuming, and I found that I was just heads down in it, and I neglected a lot of relationships in my life. And I guess just to put it bluntly, I had my world shaken up. So in December of 2007, I got a call from my grandmother, and it, just from the tone of her voice when she first picked up the phone, I knew something was wrong. And then she told me that I had lost both of my parents. Wow. It's something I've come to grips with since, and the adventures have helped. But at that moment, I hadn't had anybody in my life who had passed prior to then, and I didn't know how to deal with it. So, you know, I jumped on a plane immediately. I went to Montana because I was living separate from pretty far away from my parents, where I was living in Philadelphia at the time. And I got out there and did everything that you do, and I was supported by family. But after a couple of weeks, I went back to Philadelphia and back to the business. And, I mean, truth be told, I put my head down. I worked as hard as I could, and I tried to do my best to push it down and forget it, which sounds like a horrible thing. Well, in truth, it was a horrible thing, but I just worked harder and harder. That continued on for another, 9 months or so, something along those lines. And then of course, the economy tanked. And so here it was with this, you know, this company that for me was my identity at the time. This was the reason that people paid attention to me. This is the reason I was good. This is the reason I was valuable. And now it's going down too. And it's all I have, because it's all where I'm putting all my energy and focus into. I just delve in deeper. I just pushed harder. I just, you know, worked more and putting in I was sleeping 2 or 3 hours a night, and everything else was really the business. And I was fortunate that, you know, this isn't just me. I have a wonderful business partner who sunk, you know, deep into it, and a wonderful team who, you know, who pushed hard to get through it. But at the time, it did feel very much like a solo endeavor, just because I was so self-focused at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's going on, and I just didn't know how to stop it. So it was this kind of self-evolving, you know, circle of getting deeper and deeper and deeper into the business. My parents didn't have much, but we were able to sell their house, and with, you know, what I got from my parents, I sunk it all into the business. And at the time, that gave me a lot of grief. You know, I felt like the reason that I was able to keep this company afloat was because my parents had died. I had linked a cause and effect, which really wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And just made me incredibly guilty. But I kept doing that, and then I got to a point of complete burnout. I didn't like my life. I didn't enjoy what I was doing. I hated myself in many ways. And I was looking for a way to escape, like truly just run away. And for me, you know, that runaway came in the form of a suggestion from a friend of mine, Bob. We were at a Halloween party I was throwing, and he's like, "Hey, I heard about this adventure. Man, it's right down your alley. You would like it." And just because I had a reputation for kind of being adventurous and foolhardy, I guess. Well, not to mention at the time I was doing some fairly silly things and not putting a lot of regard in my life. But he said, "Hey, there's these guys who you know, pick up vehicles, used vehicles, and you drive them from the UK to Mongolia, and it's an epic adventure. You'll love it." And you know, I was like, "Oh, that sounds amazing. Yeah, someday when I have the money and everything settled and, you know, I don't have anything to worry about, I'm gonna do that." But it was a seed. It was a seed, and it just, you know, was there, and it kept growing. And over the next few months, it kept popping into my mind of, could I do this? You know, could this be me? Could this, you know, could this be an alternate version of my life? You know, and I think it was really no more than running away. I wanted to get away from all of the pain I was feeling and just, you know, excuse me, escape into another world. So I presented it to my business partner, and I told him, "Hey, I really want to do this." And I was so fortunate that he was supportive. He's like, "Look, we'll find a way. We'll find a way to make this happen. You just, you know, focus on what you need to do, and we'll spend the next 9 months preparing the team for you to be gone for, you know, 2 or 3 months." And we did. And I remember stepping off the plane when I flew to the UK to pick up an ambulance. And yeah, exactly. Well, I guess a rabbit hole from there real quick is two ambulances. I bought an ambulance in the US out in Minnesota, used retired ambulance built off of an Ford E350, and got it back to Pennsylvania, fixed it up with a friend of mine, made a lot of videos around it, had a good time, prepared it so that it was a little more robust to make it through the trip, and then ran into two problems. We couldn't get it shipped in time to the UK, and the second was we found it had been used as a SWAT vehicle at one point in its life, and so they wouldn't let us export it out of the United States. So last minute, I jumped on eBay to find another ambulance, and luckily found a retired one out of Scotland that some unknown guy had set up, and he was just selling them off. And so sight unseen, you know, after a 15-minute phone call with a guy that I put a lot of trust in, you know, that was the ambulance we went to go pick up. But you know, where I started was, you know, as I got off the ambulance off the airplane in the UK, it just felt like everything else disappeared for a little bit, and all that was ahead of us, and there were three of us, all that was ahead of us was this epic journey of the unknown, of, you know, jumping to this ambulance and driving and seeing where we could go. And that journey for me, it was a turning point in my life. It ended up taking one friendship, so the three of us, one friendship, and kind of breaking it apart. You know, some of the trust that had been there broke apart, but the other friend I was with, it made us closer than we had ever been. And in that cycle, so you know, when you're in ambulance, you're driving across all of Europe and Russia and you know, over into Mongolia through the desert, there's this cycle that happens, and it's, you know, you get up in the morning, you fix everything that's broken in the ambulance, everything that's gone wrong. You find some way to get food and eat. You drive for a while, hope you can find gas along the way. And then you fix some more things that break on the ambulance. Then you try to find a safe place to sleep for the night, some place to safe to park the ambulance, because we were sleeping in it most nights. And it's a cycle that just kind of goes over and over and over again. It becomes repetitive. And we did this for, 40 or 50 days. And in that cycle, there's a lot of time for reflection. There's a lot of, time to look back on life as well, because you're driving. There's a lot of ass and seat time. And for me, that was where I started to realize that I couldn't go back to the life I had before, and where I started to finally realize and grieve for my parents and come to terms with a lot of that. And so that's where my, the adventures that I take in my life began was on that journey. And, you know, I'm shortchanging that journey. There's a ton that happened on it, but really for me, it was that pivot point of life could be more than just, email and meetings and financial issues. You know, that life could be visceral. Life could be enjoyable again, and that was just a major pivot point in my life. So coming back from there, setting foot in the United States again, I couldn't go back to my previous life. I just couldn't. And I've been fortunate that my business partner has been very accommodating and has taken over some roles in the business to allow me to do that. And that my family's been supportive in, you know, being there and supporting me in a bit of a different lifestyle, in one of travel and adventure and following more passions instead of just business. Mm-hmm.
So, having heard some of my interviews, you know that I want to go back to the very beginning of this.
Yeah.
Losing two parents at the same time, that I can't even fathom something that's, you know, that painful. And, you know, on the flip side of that, I think about sort of what Viktor Frankl once wrote about suffering and how it's like a, you know, gas chamber, regardless of whatever it is that's causing you to suffer, it fills the entire gas chamber. So it's relative mm-hmm. to whatever we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, for me, the question that comes up is sort of navigating the grief of that kind of a loss so that you come out of the other side of it better, as opposed to letting it just demolish you. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I've seen happen, I've had happen in certain instances. So I'm really curious, what your thoughts are about that.
I think the best way I can express it is the loss of my parents. And you're right. It was earth-shattering. I mean, to the core, because these have been two people who had supported me and been there for me my whole life. But the loss of my parents and how that felt and how I pushed it down and ignored it and did everything I could to avoid dealing with the grief. And that process is night and day opposite from how this year has been for me. Mm-hmm. So this year, as I was coming back from Siberia, unexpectedly, one of the biggest mentors in my life, a guy who became a father to me, passed from cancer and other issues, and it progressed quickly. It went from 15 days to being noticed to him passing, and that happened as I was flying back from Russia. So that happened a month ago. One of my grandfathers passed, and he, at many points of my life, also was a father figure. He stepped in when my biological father left, and before my stepfather was in my life. And he's, you know, the reason I uphold many ideals in my life, like integrity. And then last week, my other grandfather passed. So those three things happened this year. But my way of dealing with it, my perspective has been very different. And I attribute it to learning how to deal and grieve, but also just gaining a little bit more life experience in some of the adventures I've been on. So the difference for me has been when my parents passed, it was unfathomable and it was all consuming. Like you said, it was that gas that fills the gas chamber and just sinks you down to a depth you never knew you could hit. And makes your life feel worthless. But this year, with the passing of these three incredible men, my view has been of gratitude that they were in my life, that they helped shape me and make me into the person that I've become. And also in having perspective that in this year, I've hit some of the greatest highs of my life as well as some of the greatest lows. And by looking at that and not focusing simply on one, not on the lows of losing them, that perspective has helped me understand that while, you know, I've grieved for them and I've given them their everything I can do to process their passing, that there's more in my life than that, that I'm buoyed up by all of these other great and amazing things and amazing people in my life, rather than being pulled down and sunk to those depths. So I think that it's about dealing with those emotions first and forefront, forefront, and also just maintaining the perspective of everything in your life rather than focusing on one single event.
Yeah, that's actually a really profound way of looking at it. And it's so true. When we experience highs and lows, we tend to get, you know, all consumed by the lows. You know, I really appreciate you bringing up the idea of, you know, letting yourself process those feelings as opposed to pushing them down, because I think that that's really, you know, one of our first sort of instincts with emotional pain is to just try to push it down as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have found is that when you do that, and the next experience comes up, you basically have all this stuff that just isn't healed and wounds that come to the surface, and it makes it 80 times worse.
No, it's a very good point. It's almost like if there were a drain or a hole for processing these emotions, like if you stuff stuff down, it's like you block that up, and then everything else kind of gets stuck behind that, and it just becomes this... it's a cesspool that kind of fills up rather than being a healthy flow that you process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I want to ask you one other thing about the company that you mentioned. You mentioned that at a certain point what happened is that your company and your identity became the same, which is funny since you and I were kind of talking about this before we hit record here.
Yeah.
And, you know, on some level, that is a struggle that I think I'm going through personally right now. And, you know, sort of saying, like, I associate... everything that happens to the company, I see as a reflection on who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't know that that's entirely healthy, because I think it makes it very difficult to navigate the challenges. And I am really curious how you actually separate yourself from those two things, especially when it's something that you've built with your own two hands. I mean, imagine, you know, me being the host of this show,
mm-hmm.
it seems almost, how is that, you know, that seems impossible to separate myself and separate my identity from what we've built. And I'm really curious how you do it in a way that's actually useful, but still allows you to show up, you know, fully, authentically, and transparently.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I have a full answer, but I'll guide you through the process, right?
Sure.
So I don't claim to be a guru. I think I'm struggling through this life like everyone else is, but there are a few things that I think may have helped with it. When I started Maven Wire, I started it on my own, but very quickly brought on a partner. And I believed in him, and I just gave him 50% of the company, and then from then on, we were in it together. There was, you know, an inherent trust, and we dealt with it. And so, at that point, you know, in my mind, in many ways, it was still me and mine. But slowly, as he's taken over more responsibilities, and especially now, it's become more of ours, and that's helped a lot. And then, with the company, as I used it as a learning platform, you know, to learn how to be an entrepreneur, how to do all these things. Each time I got good at something, I would pass that off onto somebody who had more passion in that area and could do it better than I could. And then it became theirs. So I started to see the company slowly and surely as this set of this amazing team, and the company was the product of everyone rather than just of me. So it became this slow part of supplanting myself out of it. And the trip to Mongolia was key to that, because I had to, if I'm going to step away for 2 or 3 months, I had to finally relinquish control over all these things that I was the bottleneck on, that I still jumped in and fixed, that I still maintained complete oversight on, and instead pass them off onto the people in the team who were more capable than I was. And even if they didn't always believe that, I knew that they could, and allow them to step up and rise to the occasion and take it onto their own. So that kind of facilitated this, it's now ours instead of mine. Mm-hmm. And that's just continued over time. So, and it's gone further and further. So early this year, I stepped back from being a full manager, runner of parts of the organization, into being chairman and allowing my partner to step forward as CEO and run the day-to-day operations. And that, again, became this further separation. Hmm. So it was a process that took many years, and I can't say there's one single thing that led to it, but I do know, I'm starting up a new project now, and I do know that in going into that, I'm intentionally setting up this project as a community, as a people thing rather than as a Chris Plow thing. I don't want it to be the Chris Plow show, and I don't want me to be the sole reason that it exists. I want to bring in other stories and influences into it. So I don't know if I can achieve this, to be 100% honest. I don't know if I can build that and still keep my identity somewhat separate from it, so that I'm not completely entangled into it, but I'm attempting to.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting as we're sort of building our team and going through this transition. I can understand how that would lead to that. You know, you brought up something else. Where you said that somehow in your head, because of the money that you got from selling your parents' house, you had sort of linked cause and effect. And it obviously led to a lot of sort of self-loathing and all those things. And I think that when events in our lives, especially the lows happen, we have a tendency to link cause and effect. And I'm really curious how you unlink them.
For me, it was simply addressing it, and it was a latent cause and effect that I had linked. And it's the first time that I expressed it was actually last November. So Jason, who we were talking about earlier, he pulled together a group of people into a mastermind, and I'd never done one before. And it started with us getting together in a room and telling our hero's journey. And fortunate, one of the first people to go up was just incredibly vulnerable with their life and what they'd been through to a level that I didn't expect. And so it set the tone for everyone. And when I went up, I started talking about, this is what I went through, and this was losing my parents, and I didn't fully realize it, but by being in the flow and going with the conversation, it came up, and I said, look, I feel intense guilt over the fact that the only reason I am where I am today is because my parents died, that they were the, that money and them passing was the sole factor for, hitting this point of success, at least, from the outside viewed as success. And it was the support of people in that group who called me to terms on it, said, look, you're looking at this wrong, that you would have found a way if that money didn't come through. And second, if there was a way to use that money, your parents probably would have been very proud to use it in this particular way to save people's jobs and create something that has meaning. So I honestly owe it to them to call me out on it. And from there, I've been able to process it through and think through it many times, and finally come to terms with the fact that it was just a complete false connection, that I was just taking one powerful moment of my life and another powerful and linking them together in a cause and effect that was wrong. And it's taken me a few months, but I don't feel any guilt over it now. Matter of fact, I'm proud that that's the way that I could have used what little they provided me.
I love that.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that's helpful to all of this, if I can, kind of break on for a second, is time for reflection. That was key to me in the trip through Mongolia. But, this year, I began a motorcycle trip in May that was supposed to last for a few weeks. I was going down to Austin. I was going to see some friends in El Paso. Well, I was going to go to the memorial for Al, my mentor who passed in El Paso, and then head home. And I'm fortunate to have freedom in my life, but since I can work from pretty much anywhere, that motorcycle ride has continued since. I will finally make it home for the first time in about a week. But when you're in doing that and deciding to take this motorcycle ride, you know, I'm on the road most days for between 5 to 9 hours, and I don't listen to headphones or audiobooks or podcasts while I'm doing so, which I usually love to do. It's part of how I drive in a car. Instead, I chose not to, just because I find that as I get into at least an hour, maybe 2 hours in, I hit a zone where my mind just starts bringing these things up. And whether it's issues that I need to deal with that I finally confront and think my way through, just brute forcing my way through, dealing with the losses, you know, this year that we talked about, gaining the perspective, or creative ideas for projects that I want to start, I find that they really start to flow. So for me, it's about having that space that you create for yourself that allows enough time for your subconscious, or, you know, however you want to express it, but allows time for those ideas to percolate up and for you to process them and come to terms with them. And I think that's as important as much emotionally as it is intellectually.
Well, let me ask you this. I want to get into this idea of creating space for reflection, but before we do that, you know, you said that the trip from UK to Mongolia was sort of a turning point. And, you know, I feel like every time I have a story on the show, it really is sort of a hero's journey where, you know, it's rock bottom or your version of rock bottom that becomes the catalyst for, you know, real growth and real change. Now, the question to me is, you know, if we want to bring about a turning point in our lives, is rock bottom necessary, or can we bring the turning point about without rock bottom? And if so, how?
I love the question. And it's one that I've been pondering quite a bit, because I'd like to find a way to affect change in people's lives. I think that there has to be a catalyzing moment, but I truly hope it doesn't always have to be rock bottom. I'll be honest, in my life, many times it's the pain of depression that is the catalyst to push me to change certain things in my life. But I wonder if maybe just being exposed to the right people or the right ideas can have the same effect. Maybe it's not as dramatic a turnaround, but maybe it's still that inflection point that leads you in a different direction. So one thing I've been thinking about was a lot of the network and the people that I have now, who I spend a lot of time with and whose ideas influence me, it all started back in, this must have been 2011. Tim Ferriss put on an event called the Open the Kimono event. And it was for authors, learn how to market books, and it had a significant price point for entry, all these things. I don't know exactly why I decided to go, because I at the time had no intention of ever writing a book. But I went, and what I found there was this group of people. There was 120 people there, and I don't know that I was yet ready to be part of that group. I was close, but I opened myself up to just the experience. And I found so many genuine people there who had gone through these various paths in life, and paths that were unexpected, and people who defined success in different ways. There were people who made hundreds of millions of dollars, and there were people who just got by and used travel hacking in order to see the world. And there were artists and authors, but everybody had defined their own version of success, and they had gone after it, and they had gone after it often in paths that were unexpected. And that's led me from that point on to continue trying to find these interesting people and sit down and have conversations with them. And I find that I'm greatly influenced by many of the ideas they present that resonate with me. And often, you know, I try to share my own ideas in hopes of helping them. But that changed my view of what networking was, of what the people around you can influence, of how genuine people can be in trying to help out. So it was a smaller inflection point, but it's definitely one of the ones I can see in my life where, maybe I didn't take a 180 degree change, but maybe it was, a 30 or 60 degree, just inflection that has led me to a different point. So I guess maybe a more concise answer is I think there are positive events that can happen to influence it, but maybe they're not as dramatic.
Yeah, I love that. And of course, having recently sat down with you and Jason and had dinner with Jason and having interviewed Jason, I can see, how the kinds of people they are around can have such a dramatic effect. I want to ask you something you said, ask a question about something you said about this idea of defining your own version of success. I think that as much as I hate to say this, I think to some degree we pay lip service to that. Mm-hmm. And when you do define your own version of success, inevitably you're going to run into resistance from people in your lives. And sometimes, the willingness to live by your own definition of success is going to come at the cost of some things that really hurt.
Oh yeah.
And I really want to hear how you handle that and how you deal with that and how you just navigate it without letting it tear you apart inside.
So it is actually something that I've consciously done over the past few years. So let me see if I can articulate, and then if anything's not clear, just help me. So I remember, growing up, and I had parents who said, look, you can, anything you want to do, as long as you're not hurting anybody, we'll support you. If you want to be an artist, you want to be all these things, we'll support you. But at the same time, there was still this kind of nudge from my parents and support group and others around me to say, look, the path was excel in school, go to college, excel in college, get out of college, get into a good job, work your way up that job to, a point of management, and then, retire and be happy with your life. That was a clear path, and in many ways, one that I bought into. So when I graduate high school, I ended up moving out east, and I had to drop out of college because I ran out of money. But everything I did from that point, of the jobs I worked at, was this stepping up process of making more money, having more things, making my life more complete on with all of these trappings. And I always thought that if I reached $1 million, if I had $1 million, I would be happy. And I equated that dollar value to happiness. To the point where I would joke with my grandmother and I would say, look, I tell you what, the first $1 million I make is yours. But you have to let me keep it long enough to make the second million, and it was our joke but it was my goal. That was my life goal that I had to attain. I remember becoming very disillusioned with that, in kind of the pits of my depression before Mongolia. And then once I returned from Mongolia, it didn't resonate with me at all anymore. It didn't drive me. I had, to get up in the morning and to try to work to earn this dollar value, it meant nothing. And to go from being somebody who was very ambitious and driven and, could work all-nighters and just push myself to do anything, to hitting a point where I felt none of that drive and felt just lazy and unmotivated. That became very painful to me, for me, to the point where then I started to look for other things that I could focus on. And that then led me to finding value instead in money into connecting with people, that in connecting people is where you find value. And that was great for a while, but then that started to feel slightly totally unfulfilling. And then it became, okay, so connecting with people is great, but if you connect with people and you don't have an impact, if you're not helping people in some way, then you don't have a full motivation. And so it's just kind of shifted over time. But what I have given myself is the freedom to follow those motivations and go through. And many people in my life have been very supportive of this. I'll be honest with you, there's people in my family who don't get it. They just don't understand. but they're still willing to be supportive. I know because I can look them in the eyes when I tell them that the plans I have, things I want to do, and I can tell in their eyes it doesn't resonate, but they still support me. My business partner, for example, you know, supports me in these endeavors that I want to do, and he's a phenomenal man. But there have been other people in my life who didn't at all, or sometimes the environment wasn't conducive to it. You know, I felt like when I was in Philadelphia, it was a great place and I had great friends, but it was very much about the rat race, about having and being, and if you didn't have these certain things, you didn't, you know, match the mold. So I cut the people out of my life very specifically who weren't supportive of what I wanted to do. And I moved from Philadelphia, and I bought a small property in South Dakota without knowing anybody there, and literally just dropped my stuff off and started traveling. And because that was what I wanted, that was part of my goal, was to travel, and part of how I define success. And I just didn't let anything hold me back. Now, that sounds kind of rosy, but there were points in that time of self-doubt and depression. But I look at those times differently now. I look at those times as the pain that prods you forward, the pain that tells you something's not right and you need to find something new, instead of the swallowing depths. And as long as I have that as my guiding compass, I think it can work. So for other people, it's the same. If an environment or a person's not conducive to what how you've defined success, you have to at least minimize their impact on your life. At the most, just straight cut them out. And I think that it is your duty to do that in order to create the life that you want, because you're ultimately responsible for your own happiness.
Hey everybody, it's Srini. I hope you're having a fantastic day. Let's take a quick break to thank today's sponsor, 99designs.com. If you're a small business owner that's just getting started, I know it can be really hard to find great resources. And at 99designs, you get access to over 310,000 designers. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, a professional looking website with great branding, it's not an option today, but an absolute necessity. And spending time on the branding of the Unmistakable Creative website was one of those things that has made an absolutely tremendous impact on our business overall. If you're a business owner that doesn't have a massive budget, online marketplaces like 99designs can help you to build your brand on a budget. And with the 99designs contest model, dozens of designers compete to deliver the best design for you. You get to be involved in the process and walk away with a logo, website, or any other design that truly represents your brand. And it comes with a 100% money back guarantee, so it's kind of a no-brainer. Visit 99designs.com/creative and get a $99 power pack of services for free today. And remember, supporting our sponsors is one of the best things you can do to support our show.
Wow. Really, just that's mind blowing.
So hopefully articulated well. Like, I've never really, some of these thoughts I've never really sat down and really thought all the way through, other than on my bike rides.
Well, I've been known to have that effect on people. You know, the other thing I will say about this whole idea of defining your version of success, you know, I had a chance to sit down and interview Glenn Beck, which, you know, probably won't have aired by the time you guys are listening to this.
Okay.
But, you know, I talked to him about it. You know, at that level, you're kind of like, okay, well, I mean, where else do you go from here? And he said, you know, Srini, I have a friend who's a billionaire. And, you know, he said, okay, Glenn, what does success look like for you? And he said, you know, okay, is it this much money, this much money? He said, here's the problem. He said, if you don't sit down and define what it looks like for you, you won't recognize it when you get there. Mm. And then it just becomes this bottomless pit.
Yeah, it does. So I hope this comes across right, but, you know, I had that goal of I wanted to be worth $1 million. And on my 33rd birthday, I sat down and I started working out numbers. And I realized that I had passed that. Now, paper money, it's company worth and everything else, so it's you know, not real per se. You know, can always disappear. But I had passed that when I was 30. That, you know, because I hadn't tracked that goal, and that was my driving goal, and I'd never really looked at it. That I had passed it without ever realizing it, and my life was no better. Hmm. So I would say the thing I would add to that is not just realizing what success is to you and watching it, but making sure that if you hit the point or you get close to what you think success is your life better for it? Or is it a false success? Is it leading you, you know, further astray because it's a goal that just is bullshit?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's start talking about this idea of creating a space for reflection. And actually, one, how you do that. I mean, obviously, you've done it through your motorcycle journeys, and I want to hear you talk about them in a bit more depth and kind of. One sort of what kinds of reflections you've got out of it, and you know, how do we, you know, when we create our spaces for reflection, how do you get something useful out of that that you actually can bring forward into your life as opposed to seeming like you're, you know, doing something with no purpose?
Let me tackle that tactical portion first. I think that sure. may be the easier portion, and then we can get into, you know, ways that I've achieved space, and maybe you have some ideas, and we can talk back and forth. But I think that the tactical is actually easier. The tactical is, you know, if you create space and you have ideas or you recognize untruths in your life or things that you want to change, at the moment they're realized because thoughts are fleeting, write them down. And then at the end of the week, at the end of whatever time you have, sit down and review those and read through. Okay, these are the things I've noticed. These are the things that bubbled up into my mind that I need to address, or these are things I need to think, you know, further on. And then prioritize doing so and looking at them. I also find as I come to these like little mini revelations that I'll talk them through with people I trust, you know, people who I know, you know, will give me the space of not being non-judgmental, but also will hold me to task if an idea is true or not. They'll hold me to task on it, and bounce that off of them and get the reflection off of them to see how that feels. Does it still feel the same? And then if it does, then you need to implement it into some type of daily practice where you then can utilize that change. So, you know, when I realized that I needed to move out of Philadelphia, that I needed to get further back west where I felt more at home, after talking this over, I started then with, okay, my first daily steps were to write down the things I needed to do in order to accomplish and just make little, you know, small steps. And at first, that was all I did each day. I sat down and I said, okay, well, I need to do this. And I would just write a list. And then the daily process became, okay, which of these small things can I take and knock off today in order to make progress towards that eventual goal? And 100% honest, I didn't always tackle a task every day that took me closer to that. I got wrapped up in issues and, urgent but non-priority issues that kind of consumed me, but I always got back to it. And that's how I made my eventual progress to it. And which then led towards the change. If a change is smaller, you might be able to implement it immediately and then just have a reminder practice each day that keeps you on track with it. If it's larger, you might have to step your way up to it. But I do believe it's that daily practice that is habit forming and helps you get there.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think a daily practice of any sort is absolutely essential. I mean, just whatever it is, whether it's writing, you know, whatever that might be, I think it's really just one of those things that I found that, you know, I think it's that whole quote, right? We underestimate what we overestimate what we can do in a day, but we underestimate what we could do in a year.
Oh yeah, exactly. That's exactly it.
Interesting. Well, let's talk specifically about sort of the stories of these motorcycle rides. I mean, we've really kind of given people a way for creating space. And that's, you know, the reality is, I mean, for me, I get it through surfing. It sounds like you get it through these motorcycle rides. So talk to me about, the motorcycle rides, especially the most recent one, which is the one that really got my attention. Talk to me about the story and the journey of that.
Yeah. So these rides for me have become a yearly practice, I guess. I rode a rickshaw 3,000 miles across India and kind of from the furthest southeastern tip to as far as or southwestern tip to as far as I could get in the northeast. I just this year rode a motorcycle across Siberia in winter from Irbit, where they make the Ural motorcycle, to Salakhard, which is the only town in the world that's in the Arctic Circle. And then later, actually in October, I'm you know, riding a moto taxi, so kind of a motorcycle contraption across the Andes in Peru. And I find that by having these adventures, that they're a reflection not only to give you time, like you were talking about, the time and space to think, but they also reconnect you, I think, with the more visceral stresses in life of safety and food and enjoying the company of others, rather than the less visceral pains that we all feel around email and deadlines, etc. And I think that reset and that walkway is important. And the one to Siberia is hands down, without a doubt, my absolute favorite one I've done to date. And because it was so difficult, I think it'll remain that way. So where a lot of these have come from is I utilize a group called the Adventurists, and they put together these absolute crazy adventures. But what they do is they provide a framework that you can jump into without support. What I mean by that is they arranged to make sure that we had a vehicle in Irbit when we arrived, that we would have a motorcycle and sidecar to be able to drive with. And you know, they put on a party if you make it to the end. But everything in the middle, the path you take, supporting yourself, taking care of each other, you know, if you survive or die, you know, really that's on you. That is your responsibility, as I think any good adventure should. You know, it should stress you, and it should put you in a place where you are ultimately responsible for yourself. And I, you know, I've dealt with cold a lot in my life. I was born in Montana. I've spent a good bit of time up north. You know, I've dealt with temperatures down to maybe minus 10, minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit. But I was blown away by how different temperatures get when you hit minus 30 and below, and starting into the minus 40s. And I think that was the first thing that was just a complete eye-opener when we got there. So I didn't know anybody who was doing this. You know, in total, there were, I think, 17 people who decided to go on this crazy adventure. And some people knew each other, some people didn't. I just knew that if I showed up in a place like this for an adventure like this, I would meet interesting people and we would very likely get along. So, you know, I show up and fast friends, you know, we start getting along and doing well, and a few of us decide we'd like to travel together. In total, there were five of us, including myself. And I remember on our first day of going out for like a test drive, just to learn how to drive a motorcycle and sidecar, because it's completely different. And doing so on ice roads when you have zero traction. Brakes are mostly worthless on the roads. In traveling less than a mile, because I hadn't geared up fully, I figured it was just a test drive, traveling less than a mile, I lost total feeling in my right hand and couldn't move my fingers and couldn't move my thumb. And it just made me aware at that moment of just how dangerous a trek like this was going to be, where we're going to do 1,800 miles across, you know, Siberia in winter. And it really set the tone. And I'll be honest, as we set off, you know, many of these adventures I kind of do very lightheartedly. I don't do a lot of prep. I don't do a lot of research. I just know that I'm flexible and can make my way through. I was anxious. I didn't know exactly how this was going to turn out. But I did my best to trust in myself and the friends around me. And we set off. And the first, when you leave Irbit, and you go into Salakhard, you kind of have a western route and you have an eastern route. The western route is mostly on highways and is difficult, but in comparison to the east route is fairly easy. We chose to go the eastern route because we wanted some I guess more adventure, being a bit foolhardy, all of those things. And the first couple of days, first day and a half on that eastern route is also quite easy. You're on main roads, but it's difficult. You're getting used to driving these motorcycles and sliding kind of on the road and not being able to track in a straight line. you start feeling all the little places in your outer layers that are letting air through, and it's stinging your skin, and you start learning how to wrap yourself up better. So it's a great learning experience. That goes on for a bit, and then at the end of day two, we decide that we're going to camp outside because you can't always find a place to hole up or get someplace warm there. And so we decided to camp outside. We're in high spirits. We clear our camp, get everything set down. Realized we're not able to start a fire. We're having a lot of trouble with that. But it's okay. We've got a little camp stove. We cook up some warm meal, you know, eat, go to bed. By 9 o'clock, everything's happy-go-lucky. I remember I woke up that night at about midnight, somewhere thereabouts. And I couldn't feel my feet, and I started panicking a little bit, and I couldn't move my feet either. So I had to figure out what to do, and I tried moving around to get blood circulation going there in the sleeping bag, because I really didn't want to get out, because at least the sleeping bag and tent had warmed up a good bit more from the outside. Outside it was about -33, -34 degrees, something along those lines. And it just wasn't working. So I ended up taking my foot, and I could, in my mummy sleeping bag, pull up one foot at a time into my hand, and I could use my hand to flex my foot back and forth until my hand warmed it up, and then I got enough blood flow going to feel my toes and move my toes again. But I can only do one foot at a time. So I had to like move one foot up, do that, put it down, move the other foot up, do that, put it down. And I remember doing that for a little while, and then I looked at my clock. And it was like, I don't know, 12:07 or something along those lines. And I knew that the sun wasn't going to come up and it wasn't going to start to warm up until, you know, at the earliest 7 o'clock, but most likely 9 o'clock or so. And I didn't know what to do. I started to hyperventilate a little bit. I started to freak out. But it was in that moment that I just realized there wasn't another choice. My choice was sit there and move your feet back and forth with your hands and just keep doing that until morning comes. Just keep at it and you'll be okay. And slowly as I started to kind of sink into that realization that it was just, I had something to do. I could focus on this. I could get it done. I was going to be okay. It just became the routine. It became that, you know, almost meditative moment where you get into it. And of course, I'd look at my clock, and every time I'd look at it, I'd be disappointed, you know, the amount of time that passed, because it felt like eternities. It just truly felt like eternities. And then I remember the moment where the sun's coming up, and it starts to illuminate your tent. Your tent starts to glow, and just the joy in that moment. It didn't feel any warmer, but, you know, but daylight had come. Morning had come. I was going to be okay. And that was just such a joyous moment, and I was. I was okay. I was able to get up, you know. I was able to get my feet, you know, right, and I was able to move, all of those things. And truth be told, I think it was part of the kind of getting acclimated to the temperatures, because we slept out, you know, later in the trip at lower temperatures, at -43, and I had a much easier time those nights than I did that first night. But, you know, not knowing what to expect, not knowing all the tricks to keep yourself warm, and then just the fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. It just made it a torturously long night.
Wow.
And then in contrast, the very next day, after trying to go down this horrendously bad road and only making it a few kilometers, you know, the whole day and having to turn back, we turn back and we're headed towards the closest village we can find, because we're so cold, we don't want to sleep outside. We want to find someplace warm. It just been a disastrous day, just a bone-crushingly bad day. But we run across these two people who are walking along the side of the road, which is strange as hell, especially out in the middle of nowhere. And luckily, one of my friends spoke pretty good Russian, so we could communicate, and he asked for a ride back into town. Their snowmobile had broken down. So this father and son, we give them a ride back into town. Along the way, my friend's asking him, is there a place to stay? Is there some place we can get warm? And he's like, well, it's a small town, not really, but don't worry about it. Don't worry. We, you know, drove him maybe, I don't know, 10 kilometers. You know, like it was not out of our way. We did very little to help him in the grand scheme of things. He would have walked and been fine. But we took him in. And then he brought us into his house. And it was the warmest, hot, like just like the heat kind of like throbbed in from everywhere and warmed you up. And as soon as we walked in, he went over to his wife, you know, said a couple of words. And then all of a sudden, hot tea was coming out. And you know, there was no question about it. And then he told us, you know, right then, he's like, look, you're staying the night. You know, you can go in the morning, but you're staying the night. And it was just so incredible that somebody would go that far out of their way to help people who they didn't know, you know, had no reason to trust. And then, you know, as we're sitting there, you know, the meals start coming out. It's home-cooked meals that they're pulling out of the cellar. And it was like nonstop, course after course after course, you know, just small stuff, but it keeps coming. And I'm looking at these people going, you know, I know that they have next to nothing, especially in comparison to American standards. They have next to nothing, and they are holding back zero. Like, they are going, you know, just everything that they can give and share, they're willing to. And we spent the night laughing and joking, and he had a hot sauna that they used as their shower that they allowed us to get cleaned up in. And then they, you know, gave us warm places to sleep on the floor. And just, like, it's moments like that. And I found them in other places rather than just, you know, just in Siberia. But it's moments like that that just, I think they reinvigorate your hope for humanity. That people can be so caring and giving to outsiders. And I don't know how else to express it. It's just such an incredible warm feeling. So to go from that low again to that high, and for the perspective of the trip. And that was just at the end of day three out of a trip that took, 18 plus days.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things that happen on the trip, but I think that those two moments especially are two of the ones that resonate, you know, most with me.
Mm-hmm.
Because they show how low and how high you can go, but at the same time, you make it through, that you find a way to make it through these events. And I think that for me, that's what these adventures are. They're a way to reconnect. They're a way to find people who give me hope and humanity. They're a way to understand that I'm capable of more than I thought I was. You know, I've always wanted to go to Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
And before this trip, it's like, yeah, I, in my mind, I think I can do that. But after having gone on this trip and after having survived temperatures, you know, without wind chill of minus 43, with wind chill on the motorcycle of minus 80 degrees, like I actually know that viscerally I could survive in the Antarctic with the right equipment. And it's now opened that up as a possibility to me. Like, that adventure will happen at some point in my life. But, you know, it's not a flight of fancy. I know I can get there. And I love how these adventures expand your comfort zone and just make more things possible. And that's why I encourage people to go on adventures. And it doesn't have to be this big, just something that pushes your comfort zone out, that makes life easier or more attainable for you for future endeavors that you want to do.
I love that. So, you know, I have one sort of final question around this and kind of this idea of how these physical adventures translate into, you know, your day-to-day life in terms of how you navigate the world, how it's changed your worldview, and how you handle things as they come up. I mean, it sounds like these kinds of endurance adventures really just transform your abilities in every aspect of your life.
In many ways, I think they've changed perspective a lot. So, truth be told, you know, if you're running a business or if you're working at a company, and you get a lot of pressures that come into the day. There's this deadline that was missed. There's this client who's really pissed off. There's this deal that you're not going to make. I'll tell you, just full out, if you've survived a night in Siberia where you weren't sure you're going to make it through, all of these things aren't a big deal. I mean, they're important, of course, and you need to give them due focus, but you're not going to die. You're not going to come back without your fingers and your toes. And having that perspective, again, I think everything really comes back to perspective. Having that perspective helps you just take a breath and move through with them. And then knowing that you're capable of some really difficult feats makes it possible the next time you hit something else really difficult where you can't quite see the light at the end of the tunnel, you can just trust in your abilities and know that if you give it your all, and that if you're willing to be flexible and adapt, that you will make it through. That there's very few things that you can't see all the way to the end with the right skills and the right perspective.
Wow. Well, Chris, you know, this has been just amazing and just beautiful. So I want to close with my final question, which, you know, this is how we close all our interviews at Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's genuine, being genuine and being authentic. I find a lot of people who in these trips, who from various walks of life, you know, from that beautiful guy in Siberia to artists, to entrepreneurs, to adventurers. But the thing that always seems to shine for me that makes somebody just unmistakable is that complete, genuine authenticness that shines through, that I think invites trust and helps to build that very quickly.
Hmm. Well, Chris, I have to say, this has just been a beautiful conversation. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to come and join us and share some of your insights you know, a bit about your story and your journey with our listeners here at the Unmistakable Creative.
Beautiful, man. I thank you for the invite, and thank you very much for helping to guide me through.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those of you guys listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
You've been listening to the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. Visit our website at unmistakablecreative.com and get access to over 400 interviews in our archives.